They sense something very unusual. Men almost never address to her the obscenities that they almost always had for us. One afternoon at the end of August, we went as far as the Villa Comunale Park and sat down in a cafe there because Pasquale, acting the grande, wanted to buy everyone a spumoni. At a table across from us was a family eating ice cream, like us. Father, mother, and three boys between 12 and 7. They seemed respectable people. The father, a large man in his 50s, had a professorial look. And I can swear that Leela wasn't showing off in any way. She wasn't wearing lipstick. She had on the usual shabby dress that her mother had made. The rest of us were showing off more, Carmela especially. But that man, this time we all realized it, couldn't take his eyes off her. And Leela, although she tried to control herself, responded to his gaze as if she couldn't get over being so admired. Finally, while at our table, the discomfort of Rino, of Pasquale, of Antonio increased. The man, evidently unaware of the risk he ran, rose, stood in front of Leela, and, addressing the boys politely, said, "You are fortunate. You have here a girl who will become more beautiful than a Botticelli Venus. I beg your pardon, but I said it to my wife and sons, and I felt the need to tell you as well." Leela burst out laughing because of the strain. The man smiled in turn and, with a small bow, was about to return to his table when Rino grabbed him by the collar, forced him to retrace his steps quickly, sat him down hard, and in front of his wife and children, unloaded a series of insults of the sort we said in the neighborhood. Then the man got angry. The wife, yelling, intervened. Antonio pulled Rino away. Another Sunday ruined. But the worst was a time when Rino wasn't there. What struck me was not the fact in itself, but the consolidation around Leela of hostilities from different places. Giliola's mother gave a party for her name day. Her name was Rosa, if I remember right, and invited people of all ages. Since her husband was the baker at the Salata pastry shop, things were done on a grand scale. There was an abundance of cream puffs, pastries with cassata filling, sfogliatelle, almond pastries, liqueurs, soft drinks, and dance records, from the most ordinary to the latest fashion. People came who would never come to our kids' parties. For example, the pharmacist and his wife, and their oldest son, Gino, who was going to high school like me. For example, Maestro Ferraro and his whole large family. For example, Maria, the widow of Don Achille, and her son Alfonso and daughter Pinuccia in a bright-colored dress, and even Stefano. That family at first caused some unease. Pasquale and Carmela Peluso, the children of the murderer of Don Achille, were also at the party. But then everything arranged itself for the best. Alfonso was a nice boy. He too was going to high school, the same one as me. And he even exchanged a few words with Carmela. Pinuccia was just pleased to be at a party, working as she did in the store every day. Stefano, having precociously understood that good business is based on the absence of exclusiveness, considered all the residents of the neighborhood potential clients who would spend their money in his store. He produced his lovely, gentle smile for everyone, and so was able to avoid, even for an instant, meeting Pasquale's gaze. And finally, Maria, who usually turned the other way if she saw Signora Peluso, completely ignored the two children and talked for a long time to Giliola's mother. And then, as some people started dancing and the din increased, there was a release of tension, and no one paid attention to anything. First came the traditional dances, and then we moved on to a new kind of dance, rock and roll, which everyone, old and young, was curious about. I was hot and had retreated to a corner. I knew how to dance rock and roll, and of course I had often done it at home with my brother Pepe, and at Leela's on Sundays with her. But I felt too awkward for those jerky, agile moves, and I decided, though reluctantly, just to watch. Nor did Leela seem particularly good at it. Her movements looked silly, and I had even said that to her, and she had taken the criticism as a challenge and persisted in practicing on her own, since even Reno refused to try. But, perfectionist as she was in all things, that night she, too, decided, to my satisfaction, to stand aside with me and watch how well Pasquale and Carmela Peluso danced. At some point, however, Enzo approached. The child who had thrown stones at us, who had surprisingly competed with Leela in arithmetic, who had once given her a wreath of sorb apples, over the years had been as if sucked up into a short but powerful organism, used to hard work. He looked older even than Reno, who among us was the oldest. You could see in every feature that he rose before dawn, that he had to deal with the Camorra at the fruit and vegetable market, that he went in all seasons, in cold, in the rain, to sell fruit and vegetables from his cart, up and down the streets of the neighborhood. Yet in his fair-skinned face, with its blonde eyebrows and lashes, in the blue eyes, there was still something of the rebellious child we had known. Enzo spoke rarely, but confidently, always in dialect, and it would not have occurred to either of us to joke with him, or even to make conversation. It was he who took the initiative. He asked Leela why she wasn't dancing. She answered, "Because I don't really know how to do this dance." He was silent for a while. Then he said, "I don't either." But when another rock and roll song was put on, he took her by the arm in a natural way and pushed her into the middle of the room. Leela, who if one simply grazed her without permission, leaped up as if she had been stung by a wasp, didn't react. So great, evidently, was her desire to dance. Rather, she looked at him gratefully and abandoned herself to the music. It was immediately clear that Enzo didn't know much about it. He moved very little, in a serious, composed way. But he was very attentive to Leela. He obviously wished to do her a favor, let her show off. And although she wasn't as good as Carmen, she managed, as usual, to win everyone's attention. "Even Enzo likes her," I said to myself in desolation. And, I realized right away, Stefano, the grocer. He gazed at her the whole time, the way one gazes at a movie star. But while Leela was dancing, the Solara brothers arrived. The mere sight of them agitated me. They greeted the pastry maker and his wife. They gave Stefano a pat of sympathy. And then they too started watching the dancers. First, like masters of the neighborhood as they felt they were, they looked in a vulgar fashion at Ada, who avoided their gaze. Then they spoke to each other and, indicating Antonio, gave him an exaggerated nod of greeting, which he pretended not to see. Finally, they noticed Leela, stared at her for a long time, then whispered to each other, Michele giving an obvious sign of assent. I didn't let them out of my sight, and I quickly realized that in particular Marcello, whom all the girls liked, didn't seem in the least angered by the knife business. On the contrary, in a few seconds, he was completely captivated by Leela's lithe and elegant body, by her face, which was unusual in the neighborhood, and perhaps in the whole city of Naples. He gazed without ever taking his eyes off her, as if he had lost the little brain he had. He gazed at her even when the music stopped. It was an instant. Enzo made as if to push Leela into the corner where I was. Stefano and Marcello moved together to ask her to dance, but Pasquale preceded them. Leela made a gracious skip of consent, clapped her hands happily. At the same moment, four males of various ages, each convinced in a different way of his own absolute power, reached out toward the figure of a 14-year-old girl. The needle scratched on the record. The music started. Stefano, Marcello, Enzo retreated uncertainly. Pasquale began to dance with Leela, and, given his virtuosity, she immediately let go. At that point, Michele Solara, perhaps out of love for his brother, perhaps out of a pure taste for making trouble, decided to complicate the situation in his own way. He nudged Stefano with his elbow and said aloud, "Are you some kind of a sissy? That's the son of the man who killed your father. He's a lousy communist, and you stand there watching him dance with the girl you wanted to dance with?" Pasquale certainly didn't hear him, because the music was loud, and he was busy performing acrobatics with Leela. But I heard, and Enzo next to me heard, and naturally Stefano heard. We waited for something to happen, but nothing happened. Stefano was someone who knew his own business. The grocery was thriving. He was planning to buy a neighboring space to expand it. He felt, in short, fortunate. And in fact, he was very sure that life would give him everything he wanted. He said to Michele with his enchanting smile, "Let him dance. He's a good dancer." And he continued to watch Leela, as if the only thing that mattered to him at that moment were her. Michele made a grimace of disgust and went to look for the pastry maker and his wife. What did he want to do now? I saw him talking with the hosts in an agitated manner. He pointed to Maria in one corner. He pointed to Stefano and Alfonso and Pinuccia. He pointed to Pasquale, who was dancing. He pointed to Carmela, who was showing off with Antonio. As soon as the music stopped, Giliola's mother took Pasquale under the arm in a friendly way, led him into a corner, said something in his ear. "Go ahead," Michele said to his brother. "The way's clear." And Marcello Solara tried again with Leela. I was sure she would say no. I knew how she detested him. But that wasn't what happened. The music started, and she, with the desire to dance in every muscle, first looked for Pasquale. Then, not seeing him, grasped Marcello's hand as if it were merely a hand, as if beyond it there were not an arm, his whole body, and, all sweaty, began again to do what at that moment counted most for her, dance. I looked at Stefano. I looked at Enzo. Everything was charged with tension. My heart was pounding as Pasquale, scowling, went over to Carmela and spoke sharply to her. Carmela protested in a low voice. In a low voice, he silenced her. Antonio approached them, spoke to Pasquale. Together, they glared at Michele Solara, who was again talking to Stefano, at Marcello, who was dancing with Leela, pulling her, lifting her, lowering her down. Then Antonio went to drag Ada out of the dancing. The music stopped. Leela returned to my side. I said to her, "Something's happening. We have to go." She laughed, exclaimed, "Even if there's an earthquake coming, I'm going to have another dance." And she looked at Enzo, who was leaning against a wall. But meanwhile, Marcello asked, and she let him draw her again into a dance. Pasquale came over and said somberly that we had to go. "Let's wait till Leela finishes her dance."
"No, right now," he said, in a tone that would not admit a response.
Hard. Rude. Then he went straight toward Michele Solara and bumped him hard with one shoulder. Michele laughed, said something obscene out of the corner of his mouth. Pasquale continued toward the door, followed by Carmela, reluctantly, and by Antonio, who had Ada with him. I turned to see what Enzo was doing, but he was still leaning against the wall, watching Leela dance. The music ended. Leela moved toward me, followed by Marcello, whose eyes were shining with happiness. "We have to go!" I nearly shrieked. I must have put such anguish into my voice that she finally looked around as if she had woken up. "All right, let's go," she said, puzzled. I headed toward the door, without waiting any longer. The music started again. Marcello Solara grabbed Leela by the arm, said to her, between a laugh and an entreaty, "Stay, I'll take you home." Leela, as if only then recognizing him, looked at him incredulously. Suddenly, it seemed to her impossible that he was touching her with such assurance. She tried to free her arm, but Marcello held it in a strong grip, saying, "Just one more dance." Enzo left the wall, grabbed Marcello's wrist without saying a word. I see him before my eyes. He was calm. Although younger in years and smaller in size, he seemed to be making no effort. The strength of his grip could be seen only on the face of Marcello Solara, who let go of Leela with a grimace of pain and seized his wrist with his other hand. As we left, I heard Leela saying indignantly to Enzo, in the thickest dialect, "He touched me. Did you see? Me, that shit. Luckily, Reno wasn't there. If he does it again, he's dead." Was it possible she didn't realize that she had danced with Marcello twice? Yes, possible. She was like that. Outside, we found Pasquale, Antonio, Carmela, and Ada. Pasquale was beside himself. We had never seen him like that. He was shouting insults, shouting at the top of his lungs, his eyes like a madman's, and there was no way to calm him. He was angry with Michele, of course, but above all with Marcello and Stefano. He said things that we weren't capable of understanding. He said that the Bar Solara had always been a place for loan sharks from the Camorra, that it was the base for smuggling and for collecting votes for the monarchists. He said that Don Achille had been a spy for the Nazi fascists. He said that the money Stefano was using to expand the grocery store his father had made on the black market. He yelled, "Papa was right to kill him." He yelled, "The Solaras, father and sons, I'll cut their throats, and then I'll eliminate Stefano and his whole family from the face of the earth." Finally, turning to Leela, he yelled, as if it were the most serious thing, "And you, you were even dancing with that piece of shit." At that point, as if Pasquale's rage had pumped breath into his chest, Antonio too began shouting, and it was almost as if he were angry at Pasquale because he wished to deprive him of a joy, the joy of killing the Solaras for what they had done to Ada. And Ada immediately began to cry, and Carmela couldn't restrain herself, and she too burst into tears. And Enzo tried to persuade all of us to get off the street. "Let's go home," he said. But Pasquale and Antonio silenced him. They wanted to stay and confront the Solaras. Fiercely, but with pretended calm, they kept repeating to Enzo, "Go. Go. We'll see you tomorrow." Enzo said softly, "If you stay, I'm going to stay too." At that point, I too burst into tears,
And a moment afterward, the thing that moved me most, Leela, whom I had never seen cry, ever, began weeping. We were four girls in tears, desperate tears. But Pasquale yielded only when he saw Leela crying. He said in a tone of resignation, "All right, not tonight. I'll settle things with the Saladas some other time. Let's go." Immediately, between sobs, Leela and I took him under the arm, dragged him away. For a moment we consoled him by saying mean things about the Saladas, but also insisting that the best thing was to act as if they didn't exist. Then Leela, drying her tears with the back of her hand, asked, "Who are the Nazi fascists, Pasca? Who are the monarchists? What's the black market?"
17. It's hard to say what Pasquale's answers did to Leela. I'm in danger of getting it wrong, partly because on me, at the time, they had no concrete effect. But she, in her usual way, was moved and altered by them, so that for the entire summer she tormented me with a single concept that I found quite unbearable. I'll try to summarize it, using the language of today, like this. There are no gestures, words, or sighs that do not contain the sum of all the crimes that human beings have committed and commit. Naturally, she said it in another way. But what matters is that she was gripped by a frenzy of absolute disclosure. She pointed to people, things, streets, and said, "That man fought in the war and killed. That one bludgeoned and administered castor oil. That one turned in a lot of people. That one starved his own mother. In that house, they tortured and killed. On these stones, they marched and gave the fascist salute. On this corner, they inflicted beatings. These people's money comes from the hunger of others. This car was bought by selling bread adulterated with marble dust and rotten meat on the black market. That butcher shop had its origins in stolen copper and vandalized freight trains. Behind that bar is the Camorra, smuggling, loan sharking." Soon she became dissatisfied with Pasquale. It was as if he had set in motion a mechanism in her head, and now her job was to put order into a chaotic mass of impressions. Increasingly intent, increasingly obsessed, probably overcome herself by an urgent need to find a solid vision without cracks, she complicated his meager information with some book she got from the library. So she gave concrete motives, ordinary faces, to the air of abstract apprehension that as children we had breathed in the neighborhood. Fascism, Nazism, the war, the Allies, the monarchy, the republic. She turned them into streets, houses, faces, Don Achille in the black market, Alfredo Peluso, the communist, the Camorrist grandfather of the Solaras, the father, Silvio, a worse fascist than Marcello and Michele, and her father, Fernando the shoemaker, and my father, all in her eyes, stained to the marrow by shadowy crimes, all hardened criminals or acquiescent accomplices, all bought for practically nothing. She and Pasquale enclosed me in a terrible world that left no escape. Then Pasquale himself began to be silent, defeated by Leela's capacity to link one thing to another, in a chain that tightened around you on all sides. I often looked at them walking together, and if at first it had been she who hung on his words, now it was he who hung on hers. "He's in love," I thought. I also thought, "Leela will fall in love too. They'll be engaged. They'll marry. They'll always be talking about these political things,
They'll have children who will talk about the same things. When school started again, on the one hand, I suffered because I knew I wouldn't have time for Leela anymore. On the other, I hoped to detach myself from that sum of the misdeeds and compliances and cowardly acts of the people we knew, whom we loved, whom we carried. She, Pasquale, Reno, I, all of us, in our blood. 18. The first 2 years of high school were much more difficult than middle school. I was in a class of 42 students, one of the very rare mixed classes in that school. There were few girls, and I didn't know any of them. Giliola, after much boasting, "Yes, I'm going to high school too, definitely, we'll sit at the same desk," ended up going to help her father in the Solara's pastry shop. Of the boys, instead, I knew Alfonso and Gino, who, however, sat together in one of the front desks, elbow to elbow, with frightened looks, and nearly pretended not to know me. The room stank, an acid odor of sweat, dirty feet, fear. For the first months, I lived my new scholastic life in silence, constantly picking at my acne-studded forehead and cheeks. Sitting in one of the rows at the back, from which I could barely see the teachers or what they wrote on the blackboard, I was unknown to my deskmate, as she was unknown to me. Thanks to Maestra Oliviero, I soon had the books I needed. They were grimy and well-worn. I imposed on myself a discipline learned in middle school. I studied all afternoon until 11, and then from 5 in the morning until 7, when it was time to go. Leaving the house, weighed down with books, I often met Leela, who was hurrying to the shoe shop to open up, sweep, wash, get things in order before her father and brother arrived. She questioned me about the subjects I had for the day, what I had studied, and wanted precise answers. If I didn't give them, she besieged me with questions that made me fear I hadn't studied enough, that I wouldn't be able to answer the teachers as I wasn't able to answer her. On some cold mornings, when I rose at dawn and in the kitchen went over the lessons, I had the impression that, as usual, I was sacrificing the warm, deep sleep of the morning to make a good impression on the daughter of the shoemaker rather than on the teachers in the school for rich people. Breakfast was hurried, too, for her sake. I gulped down milk and coffee and ran out to the street, so as not to miss even a step of the way we would go together. I waited at the entrance. I saw her arriving from her building and noticed that she was continuing to change. She was now taller than I was. She walked not like the bony child she had been until a few months before, but as if, as her body rounded, her pace had also become softer. "Hi. Hi." We immediately started talking. When we stopped at the intersection and said goodbye, she going to the shop, I to the metro station, I kept turning to give her a last glance. Once or twice, I saw Pasquale arrive out of breath and walk beside her, keeping her company. The metro was crowded with boys and girls stained with sleep, with the smoke of the first cigarettes. I didn't smoke. I didn't talk to anyone. During the few minutes of the journey, I went over my lessons again, in panic, frantically pasting strange languages into my head, tones different from those used in the neighborhood. I was terrified of failing in school, of the crooked shadow of my displeased mother, of the glares of Maestra Oliviero. And yet, I had now a single true thought: to find a boyfriend, immediately, before Leela announced to me that she was going with Pasquale. Every day I felt more strongly the anguish of not being in time. I was afraid, coming home from school, of meeting her, and learning from her melodious voice that she was making love with Peluso. Or if it wasn't him, it was Enzo. Or if it wasn't Enzo, it was Antonio. Or, what do I know, Stefano Caracci, the grocer. Or even Marcello Salata. Lila was unpredictable. The males who buzzed around her were almost men, full of demands. As a result, between the plan for the shoes, reading about the terrible world we had been born into, and boyfriends, she would no longer have time for me. Sometimes, on the way home from school, I made a wide circle in order not to pass the shoemaker's shop. If, instead, I saw her in person, from a distance, in distress, I would change my route. But then I couldn't resist and went to meet her as if it were fated. Entering and leaving the school, an enormous, gloomy, run-down gray building, I looked at the boys. I looked at them insistently, so that they would feel my gaze on them and look at me. I looked at my classmates, some still in short pants, others in knickers or long pants. I looked at the older boys, in the upper classes, who mostly wore jacket and tie, though never an overcoat. They had to prove, especially to themselves, that they didn't suffer from the cold. Hair in crew cuts, their necks white because of the high tapering. I preferred them, but I would have been content even with one from the class above mine. The main thing was that he should wear long pants. One day I was struck by a student with a shambling gait who was very thin, with disheveled brown hair, and a face that seemed to me handsome and somehow familiar. How old could he be? 16? 17? I observed him carefully, looked again, and my heart stopped. It was Nino Saratore, the son of Donato Saratore, the railway worker poet. He returned my look, but distractedly. He didn't recognize me. His jacket was shapeless at the elbows, tight at the shoulders. His pants were threadbare, his shoes lumpy. He showed no sign of prosperity, such as Stefano, and especially the Salatas displayed. Evidently his father, although he had written a book of poems, was not yet wealthy. I was disturbed by that unexpected apparition. As I left, I had a violent impulse to tell Lila right away. But then I changed my mind. If I told her, surely she would ask to go to school with me to see him. And I already knew what would happen. As Nino hadn't noticed me, as he hadn't recognized the slender blonde child of elementary school in the fat and pimply 14-year-old I had become, so he would immediately recognize Lila and be vanquished. I decided to cultivate the image of Nina Saratore in silence, as he left school with his head bent and his rocking gait and went off along Corso Garibaldi. Now I went to school as if to see him, even just a glimpse, were the only real reason to go. The autumn flew by. One morning I was questioned on the Aeneid. It was the first time I had been called to the front of the room. The teacher, an indolent man in his 60s named Gerace, who was always yawning noisily, burst out laughing when I said, "Oracle," instead of "oracle." It didn't occur to him that, although I knew the meaning of the word, I lived in a world where no one had ever had any reason to use it. The others laughed too, especially Gino, sitting at the front desk with Alfonso. I felt humiliated. Days passed, and we had our first homework in Latin. When Gerace brought back the corrected homework, he said, "Who is Greco?" I raised my hand. "Come here." He asked me a series of questions on declensions, verbs, syntax. I answered fearfully, especially because he looked at me with an interest that until that moment he hadn't shown in any of us. Then he gave me the paper without any comment. I had got a 9. It was the start of a crescendo. He gave me 8 in the Italian homework. In history, I didn't miss a date. In geography, I knew perfectly land areas, populations, mineral wealth, agriculture. But in Greek in particular, I amazed him. Thanks to what I had learned with Leela, I displayed a knowledge of the alphabet, a skill in reading, a confidence in pronouncing the sounds that finally wrung public praise from the teacher. My cleverness reached the other teachers like a dogma. Even the religion teacher took me aside one morning and asked if I wanted to enroll in a free correspondence course in theology. I said yes. By Christmas, people were calling me Greco, some Elena. Gino began to linger on the way out, to wait for me so we could go back to the neighborhood together. One day, suddenly, he asked me again if I would be his girlfriend, and I, although he was an idiot, drew a sigh of relief. Better than nothing, I agreed. All that exhilarating intensity had a break during the Christmas vacation. I was reabsorbed by the neighborhood. I had more time. I saw Leela more often. She had discovered that I was learning English, and naturally she had got a grammar book. Now she knew a lot of words, which she pronounced very approximately. And of course my pronunciation was just as bad. But she pestered me. She said, "When you go back to school, ask the teacher how to pronounce this, how to pronounce that." One day she brought me into the shop, showed me a metal box full of pieces of paper. On one side of each, she had written an Italian word. On the other, the English equivalent, matita, pencil. Capire, to understand. Scarpa, shoe. It was Maestro Ferraro who had advised her to do this, as a useful way of learning vocabulary. She read me the Italian. She wanted me to say the corresponding word in English. But I knew little or nothing. She seemed ahead of me in everything, as if she were going to a secret school. I noticed also a tension in her, the desire to prove that she was equal to whatever I was studying. I would have preferred to talk about other things. Instead, she questioned me about the Greek declensions and deduced that I had stopped at the first while she had already studied the third. She also asked me about the Aeneid. She was crazy about it. She had read it all in a few days, while I, in school, was in the middle of the second book. She talked in great detail about Dido, a figure I knew nothing about. I heard that name for the first time, not at school, but from her. And one afternoon, she made an observation that impressed me deeply. She said, "When there is no love, not only the life of the people becomes sterile, but the life of the cities." I don't remember exactly how she expressed it, but that was the idea. And I associated it with our dirty streets, the dusty gardens, the countryside disfigured by new buildings, the violence in every house, every family. I was afraid that she would start talking again about fascism, Nazism, communism. And I couldn't help it. I wanted her to understand that good things were happening to me. First, that I was the girlfriend of Gino, and second, that Nino Saratore came to my school, more handsome than he had been in elementary school. She narrowed her eyes. I was afraid she was about to tell me, "I also have a boyfriend." Instead, she began to tease me. "You go out with the son of the pharmacist," she said. "Good for you. You've given in. You're in love, like Aeneas's lover." Then she jumped abruptly from Dido to Melina and talked about her for a long time, Since I knew little or nothing of what was happening in the buildings, I went to school in the morning and studied until late at night. She talked about her relative as if she never let her out of her sight. Poverty was consuming her and her children, and so she continued to wash the stairs of the building, together with Ada. The money Antonio brought home wasn't enough. But one never heard her singing anymore. The euphoria had passed. Now she slaved away mechanically. Lila described Milena in minute detail. Bent double, she started from the top floor and, with the wet rag in her hands, wiped step after step, flight after flight, with an energy and an agitation that would have exhausted a more robust person. If someone went down or up, she began shouting insults. She hurled the rag at him. Ada had said that once she had seen her mother, in the midst of a crisis because someone had spoiled her work by walking on it, drink the dirty water from the bucket, and had had to tear it away from her. Did I understand? Step by step, starting with Gino, she had ended in Dido, in Aeneas, who abandoned her, in the mad widow. And only at that point did she bring in Nino Saratore, proof that she had listened to me carefully. "Tell him about Milena," she urged me. "Tell him that he should tell his father." Then she added maliciously, "Because it's all too easy to write poems." And finally she started laughing and promised with a certain solemnity, "I'm never going to fall in love with anyone, and I will never, ever, ever write a poem." "I don't believe it." "It's true. But people will fall in love with you. Worse for them. They'll suffer like that Dido." "No, they'll go and find someone else, just like Aeneas, who eventually settled down with the daughter of a king." I wasn't convinced. I went away and came back. I liked those conversations about boyfriends, now that I had one. Once, I asked her cautiously, "What's Marcello Solara up to? Is he still after you?" "Yes." "And you?" She made a half-smile of contempt that meant, "Marcello Solara makes me sick." "And Enzo?" "We're friends."
"And Stefano?"
"According to you, they're all thinking about me?"
"Yes."
"Stefano serves me first if there's a crowd."
"You see?"
"There's nothing to see."
"And Pasquale? Has he said anything to you?"
"Are you mad?" "I've seen him walking you to the shop in the morning." "Because he's explaining the things that happened before us." Thus she returned to the theme of before, but in a different way than she had at first. She said that we didn't know anything, either as children or now. That we were therefore not in a position to understand anything. That everything in the neighborhood, every stone or piece of wood, everything, anything you could name, was already there before us. But we had grown up without realizing it, without ever even thinking about it. Not just us. Her father pretended that there had been nothing before. Her mother did the same. My mother, my father, even Reno. And yet, Stefano's grocery store before had been the carpenter shop of Alfredo Peluso, Pasquale's father. And yet, Don Achille's money had been made before, and the Solara's money as well. She had tested this out on her father and mother. They didn't know anything. They wouldn't talk about anything. Not fascism, not the king. No injustice, no oppression. No exploitation. They hated Don Achille and were afraid of the Solaras. But they overlooked it and went to spend their money both at Don Achille's sons and at the Solaras, and sent us too. And they voted for the fascists, for the monarchists, as the Solaras wanted them to. And they thought that what had happened before was past, and In order to live quietly, they placed a stone on top of it. And so, without knowing it, they continued it. They were immersed in the things of before, and we kept them inside us, too. That conversation about before made a stronger impression than the vague conversations she had drawn me into during the summer. The Christmas vacation passed in deep conversation, in the shoemaker's shop, on the street, in the courtyard. We told each other everything, even the little things, and were happy.
19. During that period, I felt strong. At school, I acquitted myself perfectly. I told Maestra Oliviero about my successes, and she praised me. I saw Gino, and every day we walked to the Bar Solara. He bought a pastry. We shared it. We went home. Sometimes I even had the impression that it was Leela who depended on me, and not I on her. I had crossed the boundaries of the neighborhood. I went to the high school. I was with boys and girls who were studying Latin and Greek, and not, like her, with construction workers, mechanics, cobblers, fruit and vegetable sellers, grocers, shoemakers. When she talked to me about Dido, or her method for learning English words, or the third declension, or what she pondered when she talked to Pasquale, I saw with increasing clarity that it made her somewhat uneasy, as if it were ultimately she who felt the need to continuously prove that she could talk to me as an equal. Even when, one afternoon, with some uncertainty, she decided to show me how far she and Reno were with the secret shoe they were making, I no longer felt that she inhabited a marvelous land without me. It seemed instead that both she and her brother hesitated to talk to me about things of such small value. Or maybe it was only that I was beginning to feel superior. When they dug around in a storeroom and took out the box, I encouraged them artificially. But the pair of men's shoes they showed me seemed truly unusual. They were size 43, the size of Reno and Fernando, brown. And just as I remembered them in one of Leela's drawings, they seemed both light and strong. I had never seen anything like them on the feet of anyone. While Leela and Reno let me touch them and demonstrated their qualities, I praised them enthusiastically. "Touch here," Reno said, excited by my praise, "and tell me if you feel the stitches." "No," I said. "You can't feel them." Then he took the shoes out of my hands, bent them, widened them, showed me their durability. I approved. I said, "Bravo," the way Maestra Oliviero did when she wanted to encourage us. But Leela didn't seem satisfied. The more good qualities her brother listed, the more defects she showed me, and said to Reno, "How long would it take Papa to see these mistakes?" At one point she said seriously, "Let's test with water again." Her brother seemed opposed. She filled a basin anyway, put her hand in one of the shoes as if it were a foot, and walked it in the water a little. "She has to play," Reno said, like a big brother who is annoyed by the childish acts of his little sister. But as soon as he saw Leela take out the shoe, he became preoccupied and asked, "So?" Leela took out her hand, rubbed her fingers, held it out to him. "Touch." Reno put his hand in, said, "It's dry. It's wet. Only you feel the wetness. Touch it, Lenu." I touched it. "It's a little damp," I said. Leela was displeased. "See? You hold it in the water for a minute and it's already wet. It's no good. We have to unglue it and unstitch it all again." "What the fuck if there's a little dampness?" Reno got angry. Not only that, right before my eyes, he went through a kind of transformation. He became red in the face,
He swelled up around the eyes and cheekbones. He couldn't contain himself and exploded in a series of curses and expletives against his sister. He complained that if they went on like that, they would never finish. He reproached Leela because she first encouraged him and then discouraged him. He shouted that he wouldn't stay forever in that wretched place to be his father's servant and watch others get rich. He grabbed the iron foot, pretended to throw it at her, and if he really had, he would have killed her. I left, on the one hand confused by that rage in a youth who was unusually kind, and on the other proud of how authoritative, how definitive my opinion had been. In the following days, I found that my acne was drying up. You're really doing well. It's the satisfaction you get from school. It's love, Leela said to me, and I felt that she was a little sad. 20. As the New Year's Eve celebration approached, Reno was seized by the desire to set off more fireworks than anyone else, especially the Soladas. Leela made fun of him, but sometimes she became harsh with him. She told me that her brother, who at first had been skeptical about the possibility of making money with the shoes, had now begun to count on it too heavily. Already, he saw himself as the owner of the Cirullo Shoe Factory, and didn't want to go back to repairing shoes. This worried her. It was a side of Reno she didn't know. He had always seemed to her only generously impetuous, sometimes aggressive, but not a braggart. Now, though, he posed as what he was not. He felt he was close to wealth, a boss, someone who could give the neighborhood the first sign of the good fortune the new year would bring by setting off a lot of fireworks, more than the Solada brothers, who had become, in his eyes, the model of the young man to emulate and indeed to surpass, people whom he envied and considered enemies to be beaten so that he could assume their role. Leela never said, as she had with Carmela and the other girls in the courtyard, "Maybe I planted a fantasy in his head that he doesn't know how to control." She herself believed in the fantasy, felt it could be realized, and her brother was an important element of that realization. And then she loved him. He was 6 years older. She didn't want to reduce him to a child who can't handle his dreams. But she often said that Reno lacked concreteness. He didn't know how to confront difficulties with his feet on the ground. He tended to get carried away. Like that competition with the Soladas, for example. "Maybe he's jealous of Marcello," I said once. "What?" She smiled, pretending not to understand. But she had told me herself. Marcello Solada passed by and hung around in front of the shoemaker's shop every day, both on foot and in the 1100. And Reno must have been aware of it, since he had said many times to his sister, "Don't you dare get too familiar with that shit." Maybe, who knows, since he wasn't able to beat up the Soladas for chasing after his sister, he wished to demonstrate his strength by means of fireworks. "If that's true, you'll agree that I'm right?" "Right about what?" "That he's acting like a big shot. Where is he going to get the money for the fireworks?" It was true. The last night of the year was a night of battle in the neighborhood and throughout Naples. Dazzling lights, explosions. The dense smoke from the gunpowder made everything hazy. It entered the houses, burned your eyes, made you cough. But the pop of the poppers, the hiss of the rockets, the cannonades of the missiles had a cost, and as usual, those who set off the most were those with the most money. We Grecos had no money. At my house, the contribution to the end-of-the-year fireworks was small. My father bought a box of sparklers, one of wheels and one of slender rockets. At midnight, he put in my hand, since I was the oldest, the stem of a sparkler or of a Catherine wheel, and lighted it. And I stood motionless, excited and terrified, staring at the whirling sparks, the brief swirls of fire a short distance from my fingers. He then stuck the shafts of the rockets in glass bottles on the marble windowsill, burned the fuses with the tip of his cigarette, and excitedly launched the luminous whistles into the sky. Then he threw the bottles, too, into the street. Similarly, at Leela's house, they set off just a few, or none, and Reno rebelled. From the age of 12, he had gotten into the habit of going out to celebrate midnight with people more daring than his father. And his exploits in recovering unexploded bottles were famous. As soon as the chaos of the celebration was over, he would go in search of them. He would assemble them all near the ponds, light them, and delight in the high flare. Track, track, track. The final explosion. He still had a dark scar on one hand, a broad stain, from a time when he hadn't pulled back fast enough. Among the many reasons, open and secret, for that challenge at the end of 1958, it should therefore be added that maybe Reno wanted to make up for his impoverished childhood. So he got busy collecting money here and there to buy fireworks. But we knew, he knew himself, despite the frenzy for grandeur that had seized him, that there was no way to compete with the Saladas. As they did every year, the two brothers went back and forth for days in their 1100, the trunk loaded with explosives that on New Year's Eve would kill birds, frighten dogs, cats, mice, make the buildings quake from the cellars up to the roofs. Reno observed them from the shop with resentment, and meanwhile was dealing with Pasquale, with Antonio, and above all with Enzo, who had a little more money to procure an arsenal that would at least make for a good show. Things took a small, unexpected turn when Leela and I were sent to Stefano Caracci's grocery by our mothers to do the shopping for the dinner. The shop was full of people. Behind the counter, besides Stefano and Pinuccia, Alfonso was serving customers, and he gave us an embarrassed smile.
We settled ourselves for a long wait.
But Stefano addressed to me, unequivocally to me, a nod of greeting, and said something in his brother's ear. My classmate came out from behind the counter and asked if we had a list. We gave him our lists, and he slipped away. In 5 minutes, our groceries were ready. We put everything in our bags, paid Signora Maria, and went out. But we hadn't gone far when not Alfonso, but Stefano himself, called to me in his lovely man's voice, Lenu. He joined us. He had a confident expression, a friendly smile. Only his white, grease-stained apron spoiled him slightly. He spoke to both of us in dialect, but looking at me.
Would you like to come and celebrate the New Year at my house? Alfonso would really be pleased.
The wife and children of Don Achille, even after the murder of the father, led a very retiring life. Church, grocery, home, at most some small celebration they couldn't skip. That invitation was something new. I answered, nodding at Leela, we're already busy. We'll be with her brother and some friends.
Tell Reno, too. Tell your parents. The house is big, and we'll go out on the terrace for the fireworks.
Leela interjected in a dismissive tone. Pasquale and Carmen Peluso and their mother are coming to celebrate with us. It was supposed to be a phrase that eliminated any further talk. Alfredo Peluso was at Poggio Reale because he had murdered Don Achille, and the son of Don Achille could not invite the children of Alfredo to toast the New Year at his house. Instead, Stefano looked at her very intensely, as if until that moment he hadn't seen her, and said, in the tone one uses when something is obvious, "All right, all of you come. We'll drink spumante, dance."